This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Thomas Rinaldi. He runs a blog called New York Neon, and he also has a book out by the same name. Thomas, it's great talking to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us about yourself. What originally got you interested in neon, and how long have you been? Have you been living in New York your whole life?
No, well, I moved to New York City a little more than 10 years ago, having grown up a couple hours north of New York City in upstate New York. But as a kid, my father's family was in New York, so I was back and forth kind of and in the city a lot as a kid. And there were always these old neon signs kind of in the background in the streetscapes of the city throughout my childhood. And even growing up in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, they already kind of stood out as relics, as things that were, you know, different than everything else that was around them and things that were different than the newer signs that, you know, you saw over most other kind of storefronts in New York and elsewhere. And they always kind of appealed to me for whatever reason and stood out. And then over the years, you know, there were these signs that were so distinctive and just kind of always there that one by one were kind of disappearing. And so I had just finished work on another book around 2005, 2006, a little after I moved to New York. And this became kind of like the next big project that I wanted to get into, which was, you know, just going out and kind of photographing these signs that had always been there, that I always loved so much, but that were disappearing at a really kind of noticeable and alarming rate. So I went out and first kind of started photographing the signs that, you know, were just kind of some of my favorites and some of the most obvious ones, and then became so entranced by this project that I really kind of scientifically went out and tried to chart all of them that I could find that were still around and photograph them, and was kind of driven by a couple of things, but I think maybe more than anything, this sense of urgency that it was kind of really like you do this now or you're never going to have a chance to do it because the signs are going to be gone. And over again, there would be a sign that I'd remembered seeing or a sign that I'd heard about, and I'd, you know, go wherever halfway across the city to go and find the thing, and by the time I got there, it was gone. So that it was kind of this race against time, and that was a big motivating factor. And then it eventually turned into a book.
And with me, I'm an artist, so a lot of my paintings, subject matter, I do cityscapes, and I'm really interested in neon as well. I also want to introduce, I have my co-host Rabbit here right now. Rabbit, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Can you talk about sort of the history of neon, and when did it really get started and become prevalent, and at what point was there really a decline, and what were some of the factors?
Right, so the book that I wrote really kind of its main focus is storefront signs, specifically in the five boroughs of New York City. But in getting into this project and making a book out of it, I really wanted to kind of go through the history. And there have been histories written of neon, a couple that have come out in recent years, one or two even, I think, since my book has come out. But it's a fascinating history in terms of just, you know, any kind of you know, ordinary material or street furnishing. Neon seems to have, you know, this really interesting and very colorful biography that's, you know, to a much greater extent, much more interesting than, you know, ordinary histories of a lot of things that surround us kind of in the built environment. And so there were some things that I found out about neon that were kind of surprising. One is that it is, you know, thought of as kind of being this, you know, sort of icon of the modern world around us, but neon was actually discovered in Victorian England in the late 1890s. It's in the air, we're breathing it right now, and was distilled out of the air that we breathe by a couple of British scientists, Ramsay and Travers, in 1898.
Georges Claude was the one who actually, he didn't discover it, but he was a French scientist. He was the one who actually made it into a sign.
Right. Yes, well, this Frenchman, Georges Claude, is often cited as being sort of the father of neon, and that is kind of the short answer. This French scientist and entrepreneur, Georges Claude, is the guy who sort of gave us neon signs as we know them now. But what I came to find in my research was that signs that are basically the idea of neon signs predated not just Claude, but predated the discovery of neon in the 1890s. In the mid to late 1890s, there was a Newark, New Jersey, New York City area-based scientist called D. McFarlane Moore, who was working with the backing of Nikola Tesla to find a kind of a light bulb that would be a more efficient alternative to incandescent bulbs. And this is a story that goes on, you know, to this day, the compact fluorescents and now LEDs. The idea that incandescent bulbs are not all that efficient and have actually been outlawed for being inefficient in certain countries in the last few years. But, you know, this kind of quest to find a more efficient light bulb goes way, way, way back to, you know, the very years when the incandescent bulb was first, when Edison first made the light bulb. So in the 1890s, there were these experiments to try and create a more efficient kind of a electric lamp. And the scientist Moore thought he'd really found something by basically making a glass tube lamp with electrodes at each end, and it worked by an electrical current being run through this sealed tube and electrifying the gas that was within the tube, and the tube glowed in this way. But this was before the discovery of neon, so Moore was experimenting with all kinds of different gases, and none of them really were kind of working quite all that well. But they were working well enough that some of his lamps, he took the glass tube and bent them into the shape of letters, and these were used for commercial signs in New York in the late 1890s and early 1900s. So neon's discovered in 1898. This Frenchman, Georges Claude, is in the business of industrial gases, and for him, it's like, well, what do you do with neon? So, of course, almost immediately, they discovered that you could isolate neon in a tube like this and electrify it and make it glow. But it glows, of course, this characteristic red color. Well, what do you do with a lamp that only glows red? It's not all that practical for, you know, conventional applications. Well, it was only a few years before Claude and a Claude associate had the idea of, well, you sure can make signs out of them. So this happened in France and Paris in the years just before World War I. And it's one of the funny things about neon is its early years and its origins are you know, very murky. So there's you know, constantly been this kind of historical research quest to track down the first neon sign, and no one's really done it. There seems to be no known photograph of Claude's first actual neon commercial sign. But
I heard somewhere that his first commercial sign was in downtown L.A.
No. It was in France and in Paris right before World War I. And it was for probably, it's thought to have been for a French barbershop. But these signs started to spread through Paris. There were signs, there were photographs of signs in London in 1913 being used for movie theaters and things. And then, of course, 1914, World War I breaks out. And so Claude and the development of these neon signs is really kind of frozen for a couple of years during World War I. After the war, he kind of picks up where he left off. And then still it's a few more years before neon shows up in the United States.
Maybe I was thinking about the first one in the United States.
Well, there's recently been some more kind of efforts to sort of figure out what was the first neon sign in the United States. And there's a historian called Didier Deleuzer, who has recently published an article, a couple of articles, on this very subject. She undertook a six-month kind of project to try and pin down, so what was the first neon sign in the United States? It's sort of been conventionally thought to be this sign for a Packard car dealership in Los Angeles, that Claude sold these signs to this Los Angeles, California-based Packard dealer. And so they were shipped out from France, supposedly, and installed in Los Angeles in 1923. But this seems not to be the case, or at the very least, there's no conclusive evidence that this actually happened. In fact, Professor Deleuzer seems to have found evidence that this sort of mythical first neon sign in the U.S. may have been in Oakland, California, instead of in Los Angeles. But in any case, there were Claude started selling signs in New York in 1923, 1924. So whether or not it was this Los Angeles Packard dealer sign, it seems like we'll never actually know what the first neon sign, the first of Claude's neon signs were in the U.S. But there were other neon signs being made by people besides Claude in the U.S., before the advent of these signs in the early 1920s. So, I mean, one of the sort of funny things about neon really is that for something that had such a huge impact on the look of the streets around us and our towns and roads, et cetera, that it has such a murky early history that, you know, there is no known first neon sign, for instance. So that's kind of one of the sort of funny things about it, I think.
What point in history would you say is its peak? Would you say like the 1950s?
Well, I would say the 50s neon was actually already kind of like on the wane, you know, which is was one of the sort of interesting things I discovered in the course of doing my research. Neon introduced in Southern California, New York, kind of more or less at the same time in the very early 1920s, starts to spread and become more popular in this country in the 1920s, which is, of course, a boom time in the United States, probably more than anywhere else in the world. And just because we had such an explosively growing economy in those years, neon really takes off. And the first signs are very expensive, and they tend to be installed in the mid-1920s by big national chains, big corporations, car companies and chain drug stores and things like that, chain shoe stores. By the early 1930s, the price of these signs has come down. So between the late 20s and early 1930s is when neon signs really just started to really show up everywhere. And so independent businesses, smaller independently run shops and storefronts and restaurants could start to install these signs in small towns across the country by the early 1930s. Now keep in mind also that this is, we're talking the 20s and early 1930s, prohibition is in effect. So there are no neon signs in this country for bars or liquor stores. Later on, of course, now we think of neon as having this association with alcohol in particular. Well, for the first 10 years of its existence, there were neon signs installed for churches before there were neon signs installed for bars or liquor stores. This, of course, changes in 1933. And an interesting thing in New York is that there are neon liquor store signs still functioning and lighting up on the streets of New York that have been there since 1933. These liquor stores, a lot of liquor stores I found in New York City, probably this is true elsewhere too, opened in 1933, right at the repeal of Prohibition, and have been in the same place, maybe not run by the same family, but are right in the same place they've been since 1933. And in a couple of cases in New York with the same signs they've had since 1933. So neon becomes, in the mid-30s, this is really the kind of peak years for neon, I found, the mid-1930s. It's glamorous, and it's modern, and it's clean, and it's new, and it's depicted in all of these really kind of glorified ways, in particularly in cinema. I give a lecture that's kind of associated with the book. And in the lecture, I start the lecture with two film clips. The first is a clip from, and these two film clips have in common that they both feature neon, and they both feature the actor Dick Powell. So the first of these film clips is a clip from the film Gold Diggers of 1933, which is one of these lavish Busby Berkeley kind of song and dance musicals. And there's this incredible, incredible scene in this film where there's this just this incredibly choreographed, neonized kind of performance featuring Dick Powell. And there's this, everything is kind of clean and beautiful and lovely, and the song that is featured in the background of the scene is a song called The Shadow Waltz, which just kind of gives you an idea of this is very kind of girl next door, everything is sort of chaste and pure in this depiction of neon, 1933. You fast forward 11 years, and Dick Powell is the lead in the film adaptation of a Raymond Chandler novel called Farewell, My Lovely. The film adaptation is called Murder, My Sweet. They changed the name because they thought with Dick Powell in this film, people would get the wrong idea that this was going to be another musical. This Farewell My Lovely sounds kind of like it could be a musical. So they changed the name to Murder My Sweet. In fact, it's a hard-boiled detective story, and is kind of one of the real sort of archetypal film noir examples. And Neon is featured in Raymond Chandler's book, which came out about 5 years before the film came out, around 1940. And the descriptions in the book of particular neon signs flickering and kind of giving you this sense of foreboding over the doors of really sort of disreputable kinds of establishments are really kind of shown in the film just as Chandler described them in the book. So here's Dick Powell and Neon again in a very kind of different light, if you will. So it's in that space of just 11 years between 1933, already by 1944, Neon has become associated with kind of these unsavory kinds of themes, and is by the mid-1940s and late 1940s, and this goes on through the 50s, especially in cinema, is depicted in association with these unseemly kinds of bars. There's one of my favorite depictions of Neon as kind of a you know, harbinger of doom and evil is in It's a Wonderful Life. One of my favorite depictions of Neon is in the film It's a Wonderful Life, the Christmas movie. And in this film, Jimmy Stewart is, you know, there are scenes of Bedford Falls, this kind of, you know, picturesque white picket fences, upstanding American kind of community. And at the kind of entrance to the town, there's the sedate wooden placard saying, "Welcome to Bedford Falls." Well, then, later in the film, there's this alternate reality depiction of Bedford Falls as Pottersville, having been, you know, taken over by almost kind of like a Donald Trump, not to get too political, type character of Mr. Potter, who has, you know, opened up all these dance halls and bars and, you know, these kinds of places that you'd never expect to find in you know, quaint Bedford Falls. And the first thing you see coming into Pottersville, where that sedate wooden placard had been, is a big neon sign that just says Pottersville. And neon signs as kind of welcome to whatever town actually did exist, I found in researching the book. There were, you know, welcome to this town or that town, rendered in neon. And these were made before neon kind of took on these associations of, you know, sort of overt, in-your-face commercialism or whatever kind of other crass connotations they could take on.
I was going to kind of ask you the same question where it became associated with kind of seediness, but I had no idea that it was that early on, like in the 40s. I was kind of thinking of like the 1970s. Like,
yeah,
kind
no,
because
way
no,
back, even into the 30s. Yeah, I know. The first real kind of characterization of neon in this bad way, after in the early 30s, it's portrayed in Gold Diggers of 33 and a couple of other movies, great examples of neon being shown in this really great light. I mean, the Claude Neon in Paris, after all, came from Paris, the city of light, had been used at the Paris Opera and had been used to light churches, not even for signage, but just used to as architectural lighting for churches. You know, so neon had, you know, having had these, you know, great connotations of the bright light of the future. For instance, in the 1933 Chicago World's Fair, neon is sort of the darling of the fair, and there are neon glass bending demonstrations at the 1933 Chicago World's Fair, and there are descriptions of the amount of neon used at the 33 World's Fair in terms of the miles of neon being used at the fair. By the 1939 New York World's Fair, neon was actually not quite banned from the fair, but there were design ordinances put in effect by the planners of the 39 World's Fair that neon had to be concealed behind plastic or glass or used in a for indirect lighting or things like that. So in that space of a couple of years, things had already changed. And I found that the big corporations that had been putting up the first neon signs in this country had already started to turn their back on neon by the mid to late 1930s. In the late 30s, there was an example of Goodyear Tires, you know, nationwide franchise, which had through the early to mid 30s issued standard neon signs for all of their dealerships across the country. In 1938, they start taking the neon signs down and have found cheaper and lower maintenance and kind of cleaner signs to use as their standard nationwide. But at the same time, in the literature describing this change in 1938, they talk about how neon had become so profuse and just was a little bit too ubiquitous in this country. And so this was another aesthetic reason to abandon neon. So by the late 30s, the big corporations are ditching neon and have found cheaper ways, cheaper forms of electric signs. So neon at that point becomes the domain of independent businesses. Independent businesses can be these cute little places like we have in New York, like these neighborhood institution, old bars and restaurants, or mom-and-pop kind of corner stores. And that's sort of the association we have with these signs in New York today. But what happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s is that these were, especially a great example is in the case of hotels. You know, and you think of the classic flickering neon hotel sign, and is this a place you really want to stay, versus the signs used by your AAA-approved, you know, kind of Quality Inn type motel, where you know if you're a stranger in a strange town, you know you're going to be checking into a reputable establishment if you go to one of these nationwide chain hotels. Well, the nationwide chain hotels were, you know, in this class of corporate businesses that were the first to ditch neon. So neon
wasn't there
a hotel
in New York? I think it was called like the Milford Hotel, which they recently renovated.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of them still left in New York. You know, at this point, you know, in New York, the ones that are left are so few and far between and are, at this point, so far removed from those kind of connotations of, you know, the hotel where you never know, like, you know, what you're going to find in the room you check into, what's going to be going on in the room next to you, you know, drug dealing or whatever else. You know, that was sort of the association these signs had, say, in the 60s, 70s,
and 80s. That's also, you see it a lot in films, like, in film noir kind of crime mysteries, or in scenes where if a guy goes to see a prostitute or a scene where there's a murder, you definitely see that a lot in film.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I did a blog post just on cinematic representations of the neon hotel sign, you know, which is it in and of itself is like a whole little study that you can do, and I sort of did do by way of this little blog post. But it goes back even before neon. They were using, say, in the 30s and 40s, movies were showing these hotel signs with incandescent bulbs, because at that point, incandescent bulb signs were sort of like on the out, and they were sort of a kind of icon of something that had been bypassed and you know, was already sort of like in the demi mode. Well, very quickly this went from incandescent to neon. So neon signs became the symbol for Hollywood of you know, of things that had been kind of bypassed and pushed out of the mainstream. And so refuges for people who had been kind of also pushed out of the mainstream. And, I mean, one of my favorite, and it's actually, in this case, it's an incandescent bulb sign, but, I mean, the sort of the idea is still the same, was in the film Scarlet Street with Edward G. Robinson, where at the sort of climax of the movie, he goes and he hangs himself in his hotel room, spoiler alert. Through this scene, there's this flashing hotel sign out his window, and the lights are off in his room, and so the light is this pulsing, flashing on and off, which is, you know, this kind of like becomes this cinematic language kind of danger alert that something bad's about to happen. And even the score of the movie is scored to keep time with the flashing of the sign. So it's just it's a fascinating history, just even the cinematic representations of these things. I found that the first English language use of the term film noir was a film history book published in the late 1960s, I think, that specifically in the sentence that's describing what film noir is, specifically references neon signs. So this was, you know, how they kind of came, excuse me, to have this ill repute in kind of like the popular imagination in this country over the course of the 20th century. Signs that are still around are like, you know, are considered quaint, you know, like, and people sort of go out of the, you know, you could surely find, although I'm having a hard time thinking of one right now, an example of, no, actually, I can think of one or two, of hotel signs that are you know, neon signs in the style of classic neon hotel signs.
There's the Chateau Marmont in L.A.
Oh, yes. You know, actually, I can't picture what that sign is like, but, you know, that's exactly the kind of place that would, at, you know, now in the 21st century, kind of cash in on this the bohemian mystique of, you know, what was once this, like, fringe kind of, you know, like, warning of something to stay away from. Now it's something to cash in on.
What are your thoughts on the whole transformation of Times Square? I guess you can kind of start off with when it was Times Square was glamorous in the 50s and the decline to the 70s and then the gentrification that happened in the Giuliani era in the 90s and how that basically how that when Giuliani shut down all the adult entertainment industry and how that affected the signage in Times Square.
Well, Times Square is another thing that has like such a fascinating and complex history. We could talk all night just about that. But the historians have suggested that the decline of Times Square actually goes back even into the 1920s, goes way back. And then through the Depression that and through the sort of decline of vaudeville, and Times Square was this cradle of vaudeville and one of the cradles of neon signage in this country, of course. Then through World War II, and you know, with all these kind of transients and military personnel passing through New York City, the Times Square, you know, starts to lend itself more and more to kind of a transient population that's, you know, particularly of young single men who are, you know, looking for things that you're not supposed to maybe be looking for in this country in those years. And so it becomes more and more tawdry, and there's this kind of downward spiral of Times Square, and neon kind of goes down the tubes with it. And so businesses that, say, like in the 30s or 40s had been kind of legitimate, you know, say, game arcades, you know, started to turn, just sort of morph into adult entertainment businesses. And theaters that had been kind of legitimate, say, live performance theaters when they first opened in the first, you know, 10 or 20 years of the 20th century, then turned into movie houses. And then the quality and character of the movies that are being shown as people, the mainstream turns more to television, the quality of the fare in some of these movie houses starts to become a little bit more and more tawdry until the point it's out now porno by the 60s and 70s. So that was kind of the decline of Times Square until it got to a point of, you know, having, you know, there being real public health concerns about what was going on in Times Square and economic concerns and so on and so forth. And neon was the funny thing is, though, so there were the kind of urban renewal redevelopment proposals for Times Square that came out in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So the earlier schemes were to completely bulldoze everything, to start completely fresh in Times Square, to level all of the old theaters, all of the old hotels, and build this very kind of absolutely sanitized, almost kind of crystalline, like, new city in Times Square. And what happened was, by the time these proposals started to gain enough momentum and find enough funding that they might actually become a reality, there was a backlash against them in the early to mid-1980s as being just way too kind of Spartan and too clean and too much without character. So when the redevelopment of Times Square finally was put into effect in the 80s, starting in the 80s under Ed Koch, and 90s, and then under Giuliani kind of like really reaching full fruition, it was actually legislated that neon electric signs are actually required in the special zoning district that's around Times Square now. So if you go to Times Square now, you'll see all kinds of very bright, kinetic, moving, animated electric signs. The thing is that very few of them now are neon, because neon's been so extremely displaced with LEDs at this point.
Are there any left in Times Square or sort of the surrounding areas?
there's almost zero in the way of historic neon signage in Times Square, of all places. There's the famous, semi-famous, almost famous New York City NYPD, New York Police Department sign that's over a small New York NYPD kiosk that's in Times Square, but that sign dates to the early 1980s. There's a parking garage sign that's on a side street off of Times Square, which is just, I love it. It's on, I think it's on 43rd Street, just west of Times Square. If you know where to look in the movie Shaft, you can catch a glimpse of this sign for a fraction of a second. And it was kind of this, it's a pretty grand sign. I mean, it's like maybe five or six stories high, and at one point, the clip in Shaft, you could see it was actually animated at one point. It flashed on and off with different colors, and it's still there, and the animation has, it no longer works, and, you know, half of the neon tubing has been removed, and it's kind of a relic now, but it's the last, like, genuine vestige of anywhere near Times Square of those, you know, of the neon signs that were so iconic of Times Square. Those big kind of dinosaur neon signs, like the ones that, you know, a lot of us can probably think of, various Coca-Cola signs. There was the Puffing Camel cigarette sign, which disappeared in the mid-1960s before I was around, but that was partly a neon sign. And those tended not to last more than 10 years, maybe 20 years at the absolute outside. So while those signs all disappeared, it's really the little storefront signs that managed to survive longer, and some of those that are still around and functioning in New York are now more than 80 years old. But in Times Square, you have even almost none of those. There's just this one kind of parking garage sign, which nobody seems to notice, that's kind of there on West 43rd Street.
One thing I was curious about is if you've looked into any of the new movements of artists using neon currently. I noticed that there are a bunch of them. I've seen a few articles about, you know, modern artists that are using neon, and I'm just wondering if you see in the future any kind of reemergence or you know, kind of like how neo-modernism and some of these other styles have kind of reinvented themselves and shown back up. If you see anything like that, any trend with neon?
Well, you know, neon in art is almost like a kind of parallel thread to neon in commercial use. And so, I mean, my main focus was kind of commercial neon. But of course, you know, in writing this book, I did have to attempt to address neon in art, which has a history that goes back to the 1930s, at least, the first known examples of neon used in art. But neon in art, as we kind of think of it today, is really something that came from the kind of pop art era of the 1960s, and this kind of appropriation of commercial kinds of mediums for high art, and neon was kind of just one of several mediums that was used in this way. And I think that the neon art that we have today is really kind of still, for the most part, you know, being used kind of in that way, is what I would say as really somebody who is not qualified to opine very much on the subject, not being.
So you're saying it's more in art, but not so much. Have there been businesses recreating signs that have sort of a vintage look to them?
Well, that's been happening too. That's definitely. Neon in art seems to be kind of going through, I don't know if resurgence is quite the right word, but it seems to be a lot of it going on now. And people are still finding, you know, kind of novel ways to use neon in art, which is you know, kind of amazing that it's possible after all these years. I mean, it's been used quite a lot in art for at least like 40 or 50 years now. So, but people are still finding new ways to use it, which I think is great, and it's great for the neon sign shops. It's good business for them. But at the same time, sign shops that have been able to find their niche in neon And, you know, I hope that lasts for a long time. I hope this isn't just a temporary thing. But so it's there's still, you know, a very significant demand for neon in commercial use as well as for art, but really kind of as a niche product, as a specialty item. It's not any longer kind of the backbone of the sign business, and you know, it's not really the workhorse of commercial electric signs as it had been until really quite recently. It's only really the last 5 or 10 years or so that LEDs for electric signs have gotten to the point of being available cheaply and being reliable enough to displace neon. But LEDs have definitely displaced neon to, you know, for the great bulk of its use in electric signs in the past 5 or 10 years or so.
Oh yeah, I just wanted to follow up. I think that you're right. That a lot of the neon that I've been seeing in art, it's very kind of esoteric. Definitely emerging out of, like, you know, conceptual art and things like that. I do think that it's possible that we'll see it in commercial use again, but much the way that in real estate, you're starting to see a lot of neo-modern housing and things like that. It's kind of come back in a way. I could easily see this neon coming back as a sort of not even just so much a retro thing, but just reinventing itself into something, you know, like more grandiose or something, a little bit different. You know, I could see it reemerging in some of these cities.
But, yeah, I sure hope so.
In some films like that take place in the future, it's prevalent. Like a good example of that would be like Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, but you know what? Even Metropolis from, was it 1927, has neon in it. And I mean, talk about, you know, neon being used as this kind of representative of the future. So I mean, it's interesting that neon is this futuristic, you know, icon of all things futuristic, you know, spans this kind of from the 1920s all the way up at least through Blade Runner.
Yeah, I think that it's possible too that, you know, with your book coming out, I think books like that could potentially inspire a renewed interest in it, because that's how this other stuff came back too. You know, people started writing books about these different movements and such that they missed, and then you know, young people read these books and they start to get interested in this stuff, and then it reemerges. I think that'd be great. It's, you know, what I think what most people associate now with neon is signs in bars for beer and things like that, like frat. That's like a frat kind of thing. I mean, that's what I think of in terms of like 1990s. Like 2000s neon. That's what the first thing that comes to mind is, like a frat house that got like a Michelob sign or something like that.
Well, that's,
yeah,
pretty
neon,
much
what was restricted to it.
Neon and liquor, neon and alcohol, neon and all forms of vice have this kind of, you know, interesting relationship with each other. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, that kind of iconic neon beer sign, which, yeah, every, you know, frat house, every college kid kind of, at least probably every male college kid certainly wanted to have, you know, in the 90s. I don't know if it's still the case now.
Yeah,
but,
In the 90s, it would have been like a Zima neon sign, you know.
That's pretty big. Yeah, no, I mean, I remember, you know, a kid down the hall from me dorm freshman year had, you know, had his neon beer sign, and it was like the coolest thing. Everybody was wearing it. How'd you get it? His dad owned a bar or something, so, you know, he had this, you know, this in to get, you know, this kind of like coolest thing that anybody had. But but yeah, I mean, you know, there is my book is, I think, a product as much as you know, an instigator, probably more a product than an instigator, of this interest in neon and historic signage. And it's kind of this sort of interest in these things. I trace the kind of early development origins of already in the 1960s. And then in the 70s, by the late 1970s, people are already writing books specifically about old neon signs and starting to collect old neon signs as early as the 1970s. And then this kind of goes on through the 80s
and
90s.
You can see it, some of the, like, 1980s strip malls in L.A., you see it as well.
Well, yeah, yeah. And I mean, now, very definitely, especially in the last few years in New York City, it's different, of course, from place to place. And neon has its own sort of history along Route 66 and in Vegas and in Los Angeles. It's a little sort of different than its social history in New York City, a little different. But in recent years in New York, I've noticed more and more, you know, new businesses that have put up new neon storefront signs that are very definitely styled after mid-century, say 30s, 40s, or 50s classic neon storefront signs of New York. And in writing my book, I had, you know, part of my idea was that there might be an interest in referencing these disappearing signs in New York, not just for design historians, but for, you know, people who might want to craft a neon sign, a new neon sign that's kind of styled after these old ones. And I sort of hoped that people might use my book as a reference for that. I don't know if anybody is or not. Some of these kind of fake old signs are more convincing than others. Some of them are really, really well done, and you know, you almost can't tell that it's not, in fact, an actual old sign. But others are really kind of, you know, you can tell immediately that it's.
What are some of the historic preservation laws like? When it comes to historic preservation, usually they're about buildings, but with signs it's difficult because when a business comes down, the signs go down with it. Do have protection under historic preservation laws?
Yeah, it's been a very, very difficult thing and has, in general, completely eluded the efforts of those preservationists that have been interested in preserving historic commercial signage, electric signage, neon signage, which is not all preservationists. So for those preservationists that have wanted to do it, it's generally proved next to impossible to do. And New York City has basically not been able to do it at all. New York may be in the process of landmarking its first historic sign, which happens to be neon, as a landmark in its own right as a sign, which is the famous Pepsi-Cola sign on the Queens waterfront, but which may now finally be in the process of being landmarked. But otherwise, the only signs in New York that have been able to be protected as landmarks are signs that happen to be on a building that is a designated landmark. And so there are a couple of cases, like the Apollo Theater, for instance, where the neon sign and marquee on the Apollo Theater something had to be done with it because the original, which dated to the 1940s or so, maybe the late 30s, early 40s, you know, had just gotten to a point where it needed to be either extensively refurbished or replaced. It was replaced, but with a very, very, very good facsimile of the original, and that was something that, you know, had to go through the scrutiny of the city's Landmarks Commission. There are a couple other cases like that in New York, but typically there are more cases where there have been great, some of the absolute best historic neon storefront signs in New York have disappeared, even if they have been on a landmarked building or in a landmarked district. So New York is definitely not the great example of success stories and preservation of historic commercial signage, neon signage in particular. I think, you know, there's a much more kind of sort of cohesive effort to do this in Las Vegas, where there's the Neon Museum, and in Los Angeles, the Museum of Neon Art, and other efforts have done a really good job in Los Angeles of restoring these kind of garden variety, typical neon commercial signs of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
I'm from Los Angeles, so I'll just sort of, I can comment on that. There's still a lot of signs around, especially downtown L.A., and downtown L.A. right now is being revitalized, and I guess a lot of them are not lit up, but I'm sure they're starting to light up some of the older signs. Other cities I visited, one city that sort of actually what might surprise a lot of people is San Francisco, because you have these areas like Union Square and North Beach, which are very expensive touristy areas, and there's a lot of signage around those areas, especially Union Square. So San Francisco, I'm not sure, but they may have historic preservation laws about that.
San Francisco, I don't know specifically of San Francisco's efforts to legally protect signs, but San Francisco does have a really surprisingly great assemblage of these spectacular neon commercial signs that have somehow survived in San Francisco. There's a great book that came out recently called San Francisco Neon that's sort of similar, undertook a project that's sort of similar to mine to photograph and document neon signs, and the authors of that book conduct these great, really popular neon sign tours in San Francisco on sort of a semi-regular basis. That's something that's worth Googling if anybody's interested in this and going to be in San Francisco anytime soon.
Well, there was a business call in San Francisco. It was an old bar that was famous called the Gold Dust Lounge, and they went out of business. They moved the business, they shut it down, and it was taken over by one of those chain stores like Express, but they still kept the sign within the new store, kept the same sign.
Yeah, there's been a couple examples of that in New York, but it's something that's just kind of happened spontaneously, and, you know, it's just been good luck. I think that, you know, there's a J. Crew store in New York, for instance, that has kept an old neon liquor store sign. It's sort of part of the look that this nationwide, worldwide brand is going for in that case. There are, you know, small independent businesses in Brooklyn. There's a you know, restaurants that have kept the signs of old like dry cleaners outside. But that's just something that has been, you know, lucky. You know, it hasn't been something that has been really legislated. And that I trace the history of that getting in New York back to at least as far back as 1980, a surprisingly early year when there was this old cafeteria called the Towers Cafeteria in Tribeca that in 1980, as Tribeca was starting to gentrify, turned into a, you know, sort of high-end French bistro. And in this conversion, the old cafeteria neon storefront sign, which dated to 1933, was very conscientiously kept as kind of part of the look that this high-end, you know, kind of this high-end restaurant was going for, and it's still there today.
What are your thoughts on Las Vegas? You mentioned how they have like the Neon Museum, where they preserved a lot of the older signs there. What are your thoughts on how the city has changed, and what are your thoughts also on the newer casinos as well as older casinos?
Well, this is something that I should probably not admit on the radio as someone who's written a book on neon, but I have not been to Las Vegas. And
well, I haven't been to New York so often at that.
Yeah, well, but you haven't written a book about New York. So here I have written a book on neon and not been to Las Vegas, which, you know, they should take my neon author card away from me for that. But so I'm not qualified to really speak about neon in Las Vegas very much, except that from the little that I know, which is that, you know, Las Vegas, the neon of Las Vegas, has its own amazing history, and while so much historic architecture of Las Vegas has really been, you know, not preserved, the signage of Las Vegas was kind of just serendipitously preserved in what's called the Boneyard, where these old signs that were, you know, kind of decommissioned were sort of taken and left in the desert. Like you see these, you know, photographs of those, all the big old airplanes sort of like left in the desert. And the climate is such that they don't really decay at a fast rate like signs do here in New York City, for instance. So they just kind of gathered and gathered and gathered, and after however many decades of this, there was this vast graveyard of these old neon signs that I think became kind of the core collection of the Neon Museum of Las Vegas. But they've also been able to preserve some signs in situ and restore signs and kind of, install them in the medians of, you know, some, you know, kind of prominent thoroughfares in Las Vegas and things like that. So in a place where almost nothing has been preserved, neon has actually, Las Vegas has done pretty good at preserving neon, which is great because, I mean, the neon kind of legacy of Las Vegas is something that is definitely worth preserving as a, you know, kind of cultural phenomenon, I think.
There's some examples of newer casinos with neon. Like, I think the best example would be the Paris casino in their balloon.
Yeah, there's the lobby of the bar of the W Hotel here in New York on Times Square has a great, really spectacular neon kind of backdrop behind the bar that's a sort of homage to the neon of Times Square. And, you know, something worth going out of your way to see in New York.
What about Atlantic City? I mean, have you...
Another place that I've actually not really been. I passed through Atlantic City once. I don't know enough about the history of Atlantic City to really be able to, and the Atlantic City casinos, and how they compare to the you know, historically to the gambling establishments of Las Vegas to be able to say anything all that meaningful about that, I don't think, unfortunately.
Would, here's a question. This is something I wondered. You know, as somebody who has seen thousands and thousands of these signs, like, do you have any particular one that is really your favorite that's affected you, that really stands out in your mind? Like, you know, one particular sign, any kind of memory?
Yeah, I mean, in speaking just of New York City signs, usually when I'm asked that question, it's just asked about New York City because I wrote this book about New York signs. But
sure.
The way you asked it actually almost, I don't know if this was what you meant, but it makes me think, you know, about, like, the whole world of neon signs outside of New York City. Is there anything that really resonates? But within New York, there's a couple that always come to mind. Like, you know, if anyone is familiar with the Nathan's famous hot dog establishment on Surf Avenue in Coney Island has probably the best surviving example of typical historic neon storefront signage in New York. And one of the part of that neon display dates to probably about 1930, making it one of the very oldest neon signs anywhere in the world that still survives. Radio City Music Hall's marquee is another one that I've just always kind of loved my whole life, and it's still there and has been there. It's changed a little bit, but it's more or less in the same form it's been in since 1932 when it first went up. There was a bar called the P&G Bar that was on the Upper West Side that had the most, you know, just wonderful neon storefront sign, and, you know, all these kind of graphic forms and lettering and materiality that really, really spoke to, you know, the kind of design of the 1940s when it was made. And that unfortunately vanished and was, as far as I know, destroyed. Supposedly parts of it were kept, but none of them have surfaced. And every time I go past that corner in New York, you know, part of me cries inside. But outside of New York, I mean, there are certain signs that are just so iconic that, like, you know, somewhere out there there's this motel sign that had this animated diver, and I'm not even sure where that is, you know, or what. I think it was restored. Something I should know off the top of my head. But, you know, it's just a sign that I can picture even though I don't know where it is. It's just, like, such a spectacular one. And, you know, things, you know, we used to take a lot of family road trips down to Florida, and you'd see these, remember, there was certain motels down along Route 1 and A1A in Florida just had these really distinctive signs that, you know, one by one, most of them kind of disappeared. I remember going back when I, you know, kind of was old enough to be going around on my own a little bit with a camera and trying to track some of them down, and was, you know, sad to find that they had disappeared between the time that, you know, I had these childhood memories of them and the time that I showed up with my camera. They had vanished. So, and that is kind of like the motivating thing, I think, for a lot of us who have kind of, you know, fallen into this hobby of seeking out and photographing old neon and other signs. And this is a hobby that I think with the advent of digital photography seems to have really exploded in the past few years. And you can go on Instagram, and you can go on Facebook, and there are these feeds that, you know, feature just this subject and, you know, have become enormously popular and have engendered enormous followings of people who, you know, just love the kind of visual quality of this stuff. I regret to say that I'm not one of the people that was smart enough to to start that Instagram. But anyway, yeah, so it's kind of a testament to, you know, to the appeal of this stuff and how widespread that appeal is.
And it's definitely inspired a lot of my artwork. I've done a lot of paintings of neon signs in different cities in San Francisco, Las Vegas, even done one in New York. I mean, Rabbit, you've seen my work.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, when you first told me that you were doing a show on this, like, my first thought was, like, you know, that I've seen a bunch of your paintings that featured these neon signs, so that this was obviously a thing for you, an interest. I think that all of us probably have, you know, the three of us have a pretty strong nostalgic trait to us. I mean, I know that I, when I go to Las Vegas, it was always a thing for me that I would always get depressed when I would always want to go to these old casinos, and then every time I went back, another one was gone, you know, so I would get to go to it, like, maybe once before, you know, like the year before it closed down or something, and then sometimes I would go to look for one, you know, and it would be completely replaced by, you know, by just some hideous thing, and so I can relate to it in that way. But yeah, definitely a lot of your paintings feature neon signs. It's kind of like cityscapes from, I would say, from that era, maybe the 30s to the 50s and 60s.
And some of them are from vintage photographs. I mean, I also did one of Piccadilly Square in the 1950s, but a lot of them are from photographs that I've taken in cities like San Francisco.
Yeah, there are other artists who have, you know, kind of sought to interact with these signs, not just with photographs, but like you, with by painting them, which I think is kind of interesting. You know, painting them and drawing them. There's an artist whose name I'm going to probably get wrong. I think it's Robert Collinsworth, who you may be familiar with, who has done, you know, sort of photorealist paintings of signs, whole signs, details of signs. He actually, I think, did a painting that was a detail of that P&G bar sign that I just lamented the loss of on the Upper West Side of here in Manhattan. But it's just, yeah, it's interesting how, you know, for probably various motivations, a lot of us kind of, you know, really, really, you know, devoted a lot of our energies to this subject.
What are your thoughts on cities outside the United States? Obviously, probably the biggest examples outside the United States, the best examples that come to mind would be like Asian cities like Tokyo and Hong Kong.
Yeah, and it's interesting how there seems to, particularly in Asia, have been a even greater love affair with neon and electric signs. And, you know, one can even sort of make a connection between electric commercial signs and the whole kind of, like, history of, you know, of fireworks coming from that part of the world. You know, they're more than here. You know, they're more than even, say, you know, Las Vegas. There seems to have been this kind of popular love affair with electric signs. And Hong Kong, of course, is famous for them. There have been numerous articles lately about kind of neon as a dying art in Hong Kong in particular.
I haven't read in Hong Kong and Tokyo, they're replacing a lot of them with LED signs to save energy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's debatable to what extent, because neon, you know, like I said, was kind of born out of this, you know, kind of drive to find a more efficient form of electric light than incandescent. So neon was is actually and still is a pretty is fairly competitive in terms of energy usage, and it's debatable the extent to which LEDs are more efficient than neon. There are some people who would tell you that they're really kind of neck and neck. My point of view is, you know, neon is some, is even if neon does use somewhat more energy than LED, neon is more green than LED in the sense that neon is something that when it breaks is either totally recyclable, pretty much, or is intended to be fixed rather than just thrown out, whereas LED signs, when they break, are pretty much just e-waste, so in landfill. And that, so that's kind of my two cents on that subject. But
how long can the signs last? Can some of them last like up to a century if they're properly maintained?
There are numerous examples of neon signs in New York that are 80 to 85 years old and still functioning. And, I mean, this is, you know, maybe part of the downfall of neon is that it was, you know, I think business owners realized they didn't need to create a sign that was going to outlive them. The signs were able to outlive the businesses that they advertised. So in that sense, it wasn't the most efficient. You know, so storefront signage in New York today is much more ephemeral. It tends to be, it's characterized now by vinyl awnings, you know, which is, you know, one wonders decades from now what will be left of the vinyl awnings of today. Certainly, you know, I'd find it hard to imagine a vinyl awning storefront sign lasting 80, 85 years the way these neon signs have.
Yeah, I could see, like, there being, like a faux neon movement that's, like, which is basically going to just cheaper sort of, like, neon-looking signs, but it, almost like how they make they mass produce the CD players and things like that that look like antique radios.
And there's a number of examples I can think of just in New York City of LED signs that are really, really making an effort to look as much like neon as possible, and they put these plastic diffusers in front of the LEDs to make them look like neon tubes. And I'm ashamed to say that I've been deceived by some of these on a couple of occasions. There's one barbecue restaurant in Lower Manhattan that shall remain nameless that has a very, very convincing fake neon sign. And that makes you wonder and worry about, you know, the future of neon, that even for this, you know, kind of niche market of little businesses that still want to have a neon sign, that it could be displaced by these imposters. So that's a little worrying.
I touched on the historic preservation issue, but have you talked to, like, historic preservation groups? How receptive are they to the issue?
It's just something that's difficult for the preservation community to do anything about. I think it's been very frustrating to a lot of preservation-minded people who happen to love these signs, which, like I said, is not all preservation-minded people. But it's just really a difficult thing to legislate. So, you know, maybe the best-case scenario is to have, you know, a museum or a place where, you know, these things could at least, you know, find a safe home and be preserved, even if it's not, you know, the ideal. You know, them being preserved in situ in their original kind of context for everyone to enjoy in the streetscape. But, you know, in worst-case scenario, you could go to a place like the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's just, you know, such an amazing eyeful of all of these old signs, not just neon signs, but they do have a lot of neon signs. And to see them all kind of gathered together is just, is, you know, very stimulating visually. We have nothing like that, unfortunately, in New York. And so not only has it proved impossible to preserve these things in the streetscape, it's proved impossible just to preserve them, period. And so some of them, like I'm lucky enough to have one that's sitting right next to me right now, that, you know, some of us have been, you know, able to kind of get one and you know, put in our living room or something. And there are people that have, you know, amazing private collections of neon storefront signs. But, you know, that happens in such a kind of scattered way that it's certainly not something that, you know, people is of much value to say, researchers or to, you know, people to who just, you know, enjoy seeing these things. If they're gathered together in some, you know, obscure private collection somewhere, and it's, they're really kind of lost to the world at that point. And that's, you know, part of the appeal of them, I think, is that, you know, you have, and that was, like I said, my motivation, you know, this challenge to kind of go out and photograph them before they disappear.
We're about basically out of time, but I want to thank you for being on. This is just such a fascinating topic. And
yeah, I could, you could probably tell, I could go all night. I love talking about this.
Before I close things up, is there anything else you want to add? And just to get, just for audience, in case they're interested in the issue, and you can, I guess you can plug your book one more time.
New York Neon is a great book, and you should buy it, and you can get it real cheap on Amazon. And if you find, if you know of a, if you have a favorite local bookstore with a great historic neon sign outside of it, you should buy it there instead of buying it on the internet. That's my plug. But I mean, also, you know, just, you know, if it, it may sound a little funny, but I mean, one thing that I loved to do in the course of writing this book was to patronize the businesses as much as I could that had these signs, you know, so to, you know, if I was trekking all the way across town to photograph some old, you know, restaurant or whatever it might have been, you know, to actually, you know, stop and, you know, get dinner there or, you know, buy a bottle of wine in that liquor store or whatever else, you know, so, you know, in as much as in New York City, at least now, the appeal of these signs is their association with these old neighborhood anchors, these independent businesses. You know, let's remember to do what we can to keep those places going.
Well, Thomas Rinaldi, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you so much. No, it's been my absolute pleasure. Like I said, you know, to thanks for all the great questions and giving me a chance to talk about neon.
And Rabbit, thanks for being on as well. Is there anything else you'd like to add before I wrap things up?
No, it was a great show. I really appreciate you having me on, and thanks a lot, Thomas. And you know, next time I walk by a neon sign or something, I'm definitely I'm never going to look at them the same way, you know, when I see one. So
that's great. I know, I love it when people tell me that, because the history, like I said, is really, really interesting and contradictory and surprising in a lot of ways.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thank you.